Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Paola Serafini from the University of Leicester about her new book, Performance Action. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
This, I think, is a fascinating book, which is really kind of important for our contemporary moment, because it's a book that thinks through the kind of relationship between art and politics, which obviously, given the, you know, terrible political conditions prevailing across many parts of the world, I think it's a kind of really crucial intervention to understand this relationship. And the book focuses in particular on activism in the art world and kind of political activism or activism for social change. And I wonder if you could like introduce the book by saying what got you interested in this particular area. You know, were you sort of practicing as an artist? Was it something you've been long interested in? Or did you just come to it as a kind of like a field of research that you thought would be interesting?
Sure. So this all started about 8 years ago. I was doing my master's at Goldsmiths and 2010. And that's when the protest started, you know, student protests against the rising fees, but also protests against austerity cuts, groups like UK UNCUT. And I got involved in some of these protests. And at the time, I was thinking through what I was going to write for my thesis. And I really wanted to do something with arts and politics. And at the beginning, I thought I was going to go for socially engaged art or critical art, something like that. And then my supervisor said, why don't you write about the stuff you're doing? That's way more interesting. And that kind of clicked. And that's when I thought, yeah, actually, it's stuff that's happening in the street. That's more interesting than the stuff that's happening in the exhibition halls. I wrote my dissertation on performance in the context of political protests in 2010, 2011. But I felt this kind of frustration with the literature at the time when I was writing the thesis. I felt that all of the stuff that came from art theory and art history that was looking at political art was quite limited, let's say, to a discursive aspect of these practices. And then I was reading some philosophy and aesthetics and politics, but I was like, I need something else. I need to, you know, understand how these things work on the inside. And like, I'm not just interested in what political messages artists or activists are putting out there. I want to know how it works. I want to know how it works in practice. Like, what are the processes behind this? And that kind of then motivated me to do a PhD on this. And so I went from a background in art history and then anthropology to do a PhD with a sociologist as a supervisor. And then he introduced me to all of the social movement theory. And that's when I kind of realized, okay, so this has to be an interdisciplinary framework. And it has to include art theory and it has to include social movement theory. And then while looking at what kinds of practices were taking place in the UK at the moment, because the book is quite UK focused, I decided to also include some performance theory because most of the practices were performance based in some way or the other. I became quite involved in some of these practices, having had some experience before and always making art, but never professionally. I became quite involved in some of these groups. And so it was quite an ethnographic and participatory approach that the book came, and some of the groups I'm still involved with today. And The relationships are still ongoing. Sometimes the relationships of co-production, of knowledge, of text, of performances.
I mean, you get a really rich sense of the really wide-ranging set of theories that contribute to the book and kind of underpin the book's approach to understanding art activism. And I wonder, actually, like the kind of the big question would be pinning down what this thing is. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could say a bit about kind of what art activism is, as a kind of like an object of study before we sort of think through both, you know, the concrete examples and your sort of own position.
Sure. So that, I think, funny enough, is the most difficult question. What is it? What is it not? So I start with Lucy Lippert's definition. She gave a definition of actually activist art in the 1980s, and she was talking about it as art that is politically engaged, that it can operate within or outside of the art world, that is not tied to a specific genre, that is defined mostly by its function, and that is quite process-based. So I like those ideas, you know, the function and the process. In this book, I use the term art activism instead of activist art. And this was a deliberate choice, me coming from a different language. Perhaps I view language in a different way, but I thought activist art is two nouns. No, sorry. Activist art is an adjective and a noun. Art activism is two nouns. So when we talk about art activism, we're not putting more weight on one or the other. And I like that. I think that expresses the kind of in-betweenness and the ambiguity a lot better than artistic activism or activist art. So that was a choice. But then my difference with Lippert is that I am concentrating mostly on expressions that originate from outside of the art world, outside of the institutions. So a lot of the groups that I look at, they engage with our institutions. They stage performances inside of them. They talk to them. They engage with them. They protest some of their practices. But they originate from a different environment, which is the environment of grassroots activism. And I was interested in looking at that more than looking at artists politicizing. So I guess art activism would be art that engages in political action in a broad sense. But in this case, I'm concentrating mostly on art that has some sort of relation with social movements instead of emerging directly from a tradition of art making.
That, what do you call it, sort of in-betweenness makes me think of your own kind of role as, I guess, you know, kind of creator, academic researcher, activist. And I wonder if you could say like a little bit about that, because as you said, you know, kind of striking the balance between activism, art, you know, not putting the weight on one particular thing. There is also the kind of that element of you yourself as a researcher. And it'd be great to hear about, I guess, you know, maybe like your sort of experience of doing the work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it was a really interesting experience because it was so different with each of the groups. Some of the groups I did long-term ethnographic work with. Others, I did participant observation perhaps for a few times, or I did a few interviews. I attended some of their events, but I didn't get as involved. So my position was very different in each case. There's not one position as if I was doing a long-term ethnographic study with one group, one community. So I had to think about this constantly, and I had to think about it a lot when I was writing. And sometimes there would be, you know, early drafts of my work, or even I think now in the book, where my position changes from they to we quite a bit. And some people find it confusing, but I was like, this is the only way that I can write about this. When I was part of something, I have to write we, because I cannot really distance myself from it. It wouldn't be an honest representation to say that I was not part of that. But when I was not part of something, I had to say they, because I cannot suddenly put myself in an action if I wasn't part of that process. And I think that shifting positionality is okay, as long as we're honest about it. Doing ethnography of this sort, you know, researching something that you are making, something that you are building with others, is quite challenging and it's quite difficult. And a lot of people don't like it. Sometimes when I present it on this project, they're like, but aren't you a bit biased? Or how can you be objective? How can you be critical of this if you're part of it? Well, you know, obviously there are limitations to an insider perspective, but if I was studying this from the outside, there's so much that I couldn't have done. So I guess it was about just being constantly reflective of that position, also reminding people of my role as a researcher. You know, one of the things that was quite crucial for me was that curatorial, I guess, criteria that I had to apply to which information I was going to include in the write-up of the work and which I was not, having kind of, you know, access to so much information and thinking about, is any of this going to damage anyone if I publish it? And I think that's a common concern with people studying social movements.
Yeah, and I mean, the kind of tensions you talked about there are tensions that people who you were co-producing with were kind of living anyway, you know, in terms of the balance between things like political commitments, aesthetic values. And one way of, you know, kind of getting straight into these tensions, which I think, you know, kind of run throughout the book, is by talking about some of the projects you worked with. So I it'd be useful to know what the kind of like Art Not Oil umbrella or kind of organization is. And then maybe we can come back to a couple of little examples, you know, one about Shell and using kind of sort of music, the other, you know, kind of more theatre and performance, protesting BP. So yeah, what was sort of Art Not Oil?
Sure. So Art Not Oil is a coalition of different groups, including artist collectives, grassroots organisations and NGOs, and they protest oil sponsorship of the arts in the UK. The coalition emerged out of a campaign that was called Art Not Oil, and the campaign's been active for over 10 years now. And it's been a campaign that's been targeted different high-profile UK institutions and events that take BP sponsorship, with the argument that BP is an unethical company, that they are lobbying against legislation that would tackle climate change, that they contribute to climate change, that they have been found guilty of human rights and environmental abuses, or have been taken to court for these issues, and therefore cultural institutions should not engage with them in sponsorship deals because they're giving them social license to operate. So that's basically what the campaign does and what they stand for.
And what about the kind of specific projects you were involved with? So you mentioned the BP thing. I was really struck in the second chapter about how a kind of what sounded like quite a fun performance, actually, to protest BP, raised kind of big questions about things like, say, participation and the meaning of participation. So could you talk me through BP or not BP?
Sure. So BP or not BP is one of the groups that's part of the Art Not Oil Coalition. And they started actually with another name. They were called Reclaim Shakespeare Company, because they would jump on stage before Royal Shakespeare Company performances to protest BP sponsorship. And they would kind of, you know, do Shakespearean-inspired performances, and people would applaud and stuff like that. And then that deal came to an end, so they moved on to other institutions such as the British Museum. And that's when I joined the group. Initially, I joined them for fun, and then I started including some of the stuff in the research, but I was part of other groups that I was researching. Anyway, so this group has a kind of, we can say, agitprop street theater aesthetic and approach to work. Sometimes the interventions are very small and they are not advertised, and they're not, you know, publicly advertised. And sometimes there are big participatory performances. They're shared on social media weeks in advance, and people are invited to join. So one of these bigger performances was the Vikings one. At the time, BP was sponsoring a Vikings exhibition at the British Museum. So BP or not BP tends to do this thing of kind of getting inspiration from the things that BP sponsors and responding with performances that take from those themes. So what we announced was that we were going to go, and here, see, I say we because I was involved in the planning of that performance, that we were going to bring in a Viking longship into the museum. Obviously, the museum freaked out because they thought we were actually going to try to bring a huge, you know, prop or boat into the museum. But what happened was that we came up with a way of making a boat out of human bodies. So people knew how to kind of where to meet at what time. They were instructed to, you know, print and make their own Viking hats and props. Everyone met at the museum at a particular time. There were some barriers and obstacles. Some people didn't make it in on the day. Someone dressed as Thor got arrested and then released. Yeah, that's a funny story. But then eventually the performance carried on and people were invited to join in. And then this massive longship was created with human bodies and then just like a piece of cloth that surrounded the whole structure. And there was singing and there was a slow kind of ceremonial walk across the Great Hall. And then there was a more ritualistic element to the performance. And it was quite participatory. And actually, one of the really fun aspects of this performance was that towards the end, people who were participating, who are not regular participants of the group, just kind of made it their own, and they continued with it, and they kept singing, and then we went outside of the museum, and things just continued organically. So I think that was a really good example of the potential for participation. At the same time, however, one of the things that I talk about in this chapter is how participation can also have its limits. Often, when we read the literature coming from art theory, participatory art is kind of seen as this unproblematically amazing thing. And, you know, any performance or any artwork that includes an element of participation is in itself good and is in itself enacting social change. But actually, you know, and this has been pointed out by some people, such as Julian Stalabras or Grant Kester, participation is not inherently good. It depends on the type of participation that we're doing. Well, Claire Bishop as well has kind of critiqued Bouillotte's frame of participatory art. Participation is not good in itself. It always occurs in a context, and there are power relations around that participation. So I think we need to kind of be aware of these power relations that surround participation and see, okay, what can we achieve with this? Be a bit more realistic about it. In that chapter, I look at this particular case and I use it to raise some questions about what can participation do, what are its limits, and also how participation can allow other kinds of things to happen. So, for instance, prefiguration, how participation can allow us to think about other ways of art making and other ways of just thinking about art in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue that goes right the way through the book, actually. And even as you were explaining that, I was thinking forward to later on in the book where you talk about, you know, the kind of limits of emboldening people, which is one of the kind of key terms, or, you know, the question of whether public art itself can actually be kind of, you know, kind of critical in any way. And I think before we get into that, because I think those two are really kind of useful and interesting threads to be sort of unpicked. I wonder if you could say a little bit about the balance between, crudely speaking, like the art and the politics. And obviously, you know, you've mentioned art activism and not wanting either term to be kind of carrying the weight of the practice. And this, I guess, is through the story of Shell Out Sounds, you know, and how they kind of balance aesthetics and politics.
Sure. So that chapter, that's chapter one, that looks at the collective identity of Shell Out Sounds. And Shell Out Sounds is a choir that's also part of the Art Noir Coalition. And they used to sing outside and sometimes inside the Royal Festival Hall, where the Shell-sponsored classical season concerts were taking place. And that chapter takes the concept of collective identity, which comes from new social movement theory, and it's been developed by people like Alberto Melucci. And what got me to think about collective identity in relation to Shell Out Sounds was that I saw a lot of contradiction in the way that people within the same group talked about what they did. So some people would say, we are an activist group, and we use art to make this point because art's strategic. art allows us to get into spaces that otherwise we wouldn't get into. Art allows you to confuse the police. So it is a very good way of doing things. And other people would be like, we're artists and we have a cause. We are committed artists. And other people maybe say, we are a community choir and we are an environmental community choir. So that kind of caught my eye. And I started asking questions about this. So, you know, what are your views on art? And then realized that some people had a more, we could say, pragmatic approach to it, and others had another vision of art as inherently transformative. So art doesn't need to be disruptive, or it doesn't have to be in the form of direct action to make change. It can just touch people through, you know, the aesthetic experience. And sometimes these different visions would clash when it came down to planning an action. I also realized that there were people that were more invested in the artistic side of the choir. So, you know, very interested in getting solo parts or very, very invested into making, you know, good harmonies and a very solid and good quality performance. And others are more like, no, actually, we have to be really disruptive. We have to get in here. We have to do this now. We have to do it like this. So that made me wonder about not only the collective identity. I was like, what is the collective identity of this group, and, you know, how those processes constantly negotiated. But also it made me begin to form this idea that the aesthetic and the political are in constant tension, not just in collective identity processes, but in actually every other aspect of their practice. So I started thinking about how in participation, for instance, sometimes participation can be something that groups do because they believe in participatory art. So we can say that it's tied to the more prefigurative aspect of the practice. Whereas in other moments, it can be a strategic thing. Bringing a lot of people together to one place can be very spectacular and can create a big effect. It can create kind of eye-catching media images. Or sometimes it can be because we're looking for a particular aesthetic effect. So yeah, what I started thinking was that in practice, these things were always negotiated. You know, we can get into the theoretical debates and perhaps say that aesthetic and politics are not separate, that sometimes we are talking about the same thing. But actually, in practice, when we look at how people talk about what they do, when we look at how they make decisions, these things turn to be in tension in every aspect of the practice, from the planning to the execution to the experience.
There's also the question of power, I think, as well, because those tensions, the aesthetic experience, the practice of politics, at the front of the book, you kind of gesture towards the importance of power relationships. And then you really bring this to a head, I think, in later on with the example of Shake or Voices That Shake, this youth program that you write about. And I think, you know, it'd be great to kind of hear an extension of that aesthetics, politics, tension or interrelationship by bringing in this kind of like question of power, you know, both how, you know, kind of participants can be, you know, given voice, but at the same time, how there are kind of like important tensions within programs, even where they seem to be kind of, you know, trying to foster a sense of kind of equality or putting people on a shared footing.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about Shake and Shake is this arts and politics program for young people is that it made me rethink what activism is and what we think about when we think about activism. So Shake is a program that gets young people together. Now the format is changing, but at the time of research, it was 2 5-day courses in a year. And it provided young people with a space to discuss political and social issues, and then some training on poetry or filmmaking or zine making, the skills for expressing themselves through art, and then the opportunity to share the art in public showcases at places like Richmix. But Shake facilitators always talk about what they did as emboldening, not empowering, because empowering implies that you are the holder of the power and that you are the one who decides when and how to relinquish that power or to bestow it upon someone else. What's emboldening is this idea that people have the power within them, and this is a space where you know, a space that facilitates that power to come through. But again, there were even tensions between different facilitators of the program at the time, some of whom believed that a young person of color who is marginalized in a society like this one, writing a very striking poem about racism in the UK, that's activism in itself. Whereas another facilitator once said, well, not really. It's art. It's really good art. It's powerful art. But if it doesn't go on to the collective level, then it's not activism. And that made me think about, you know, what we think about activism, how our ideas around activism are also conditioned by sometimes, you know, racist, gender bias, ableist mindsets that think, you know, the idea of the activist is a very, you know, active, usually young white man throwing something at someone wearing a black hoodie. You know, that's what people imagine when they think about activism. And how activism, it has to be contextualized, and how art as a tool for activism also needs to be contextualized. So that was a really good experience and a really interesting chapter to write, because I think it was very much, even though, you know, the way that academia works, I end up publishing it, but it was a collective knowledge production process.
Actually, we might extend that that sense of tension into broadly speaking, kind of queer politics issues. And the fourth chapter kind of brings up the tension directly between the kind of, you know, the personal being political, but that having different or perhaps, you know, a kind of a complex set of implications within art activism. And again, you know, as we've done with the other examples, I wonder if you could talk me through Left Front Art as a really kind of great example of both, you know, that kind of moment of the personal as political, but also actually some of the, you know, the balance and tension within this particular kind of art activism.
Yeah, Left Front Art is a network of queer radical artists. It's an international network, but it's based mostly in the UK. And what's really interesting about this case that I look at in that chapter is that Left Front Art has a lot of connections with Unite, the union. And that's because some of the people that are part of that network also work for Unite. So what they try to do is to build bridges between the trade union movement and the trade union environment and the queer art scene. And they try to do this through organizing events. Sometimes they bring artists into the trade union space. Sometimes they organize things in collaboration or outside the union space, but in collaboration with trade unions. Sometimes they organize events where they talk about austerity issues, for instance, but they invite queer artists to take part of that and to cover a wide range of political issues. So I was talking to one of the activists from Unite that was telling me a bit about the difficulties in doing this work. I said that difficulties came from both sides. On the one hand, queer artists are not used to being part of unions, he said, because of the kind of labor that they do. Also, they don't trust the culture of the unions. They think that it's not inviting for them. That's quite traditional. That's very male and heteronormative. On the other hand, at the union, sometimes there has been a bit of resistance when they, for instance, look at the photo of an artist that's supposed to perform next week. And they're like, why do they have so many piercings? You know, things that are shocking to them. So there is a building bridges exercise. And the way in which this is done, one of the ways in which this is done is through the personal. Well, I suggest that it's done through the personal as political. A lot of the performances and events that Left Front Art organize draw from this idea of building connections through opening up, through the vulnerable, through showing that vulnerability, the personal stories. So it involves telling personal stories, sharing moments of trauma, but also the kind of simplicity of using performance as a medium to connect with someone. Now, this can sometimes be very effective in connecting with an audience, in making someone rethink their position. but it can also be what causes the bridges to shut down. So naked performances, for instance, which is something that a lot of queer artists in Left Front Art Network do, are something that sometimes does not sit well with the trade unionists. So it's a thing of kind of pushing and pulling and trying to create those bridges, trying to find common ground. But it's interesting that sometimes the same aesthetics and the same approach to art making that can open up those spaces can be the same one that shuts it down.
I wonder if we might take a moment to kind of think. I was going to say about the good news, but that really isn't the right term. But obviously, as an academic text, you've got, you know, the tricky task of navigating both the ethnographic material and the kind of broader theoretical landscape that you're trying to engage with. But in many ways, actually, you're also telling a story of I guess kind of success in changing the art world. And you know, Art Not Oil, even if we just take it purely on the kind of like level of raising public consciousness, was really successful, I think, both in terms of, you know, kind of art world discussions about sponsorship, practitioner discussions, but then also, you know, kind of in media debates. And I wonder if you might kind of, give me a bit of good news in terms of the impact of Art Not Oil on the kind of the art world and its institutions.
Yeah. I think the campaign has come a long way. Some institutions have dropped BP sponsorship, such as State. BP has claimed that it was because they didn't have enough money, but that didn't really make sense because they're still sponsoring others. There were some festivals that also dropped sponsorship. And I think it's generated a lot of discussions in places like the Museum Association conferences. You know, ethical sponsorship is an issue that people now feel like they have to engage with. And also, you know, at a time where climate change is more and more present in the media agenda, I think it's important that that connection has been established, that, you know, who is causing climate change, who is responsible for climate change. So it's both things that are coming hand by hand, basically.
In terms of that, I don't know what you call it, you know, positive moment, what would your kind of advice be in terms of kind of art activism, you know, partially in terms of kind of is it enough in terms of creating these kind of dialogues or raising consciousness, or are there kind of, you know, significant risks or definite things that, you know, art activists really shouldn't be doing?
There are risks and there are, I think, funnily enough, my advice comes with an element of risk. And this is because I think that right now what we need is more connection, more allyship, more transnational and international connections. I am from Argentina, and actually my current project is based in Argentina, but I've been living here for a long time, and I'm looking at, for instance, environmental issues in both places. And there is a lack of connection and collaborative working. People are approaching sometimes the same topics, but separately and in different ways. And we need to build those bridges and work together and employ a variety of tactics to address such pressing issues such as, you know, the rise of the right or climate change or extractivism. But along with that comes an element of risk sometimes, which is that when we take on advocating for someone else, telling the story of someone else, there is always a risk of misrepresentation. And I've seen that a lot in the UK with campaigns that sometimes try to do solidarity work, but the way in which they do that is not fairly representing those realities and those voices. And that is sometimes simply because it is very difficult to fully understand and then be able to represent and mediate the stories of someone living in another part of the world where you've never been and where you don't really know the reality. So I think that it is important to express solidarity. It is important not to just talk about, you know, what BP is doing to polar bears, but to talk about what the effects of extraction of fossil fuels are doing to some people right now. But in order to do that, we need to first form those links, first create that understanding, that transnational solidarity and understanding, and then find the creative and the artistic tools to do those interventions here in the UK or here in whichever side of power we are in the global north. So I think, you know, it's always trial and error. It's very difficult to work outside of your area of comfort, of, you know, of what you do, what you know. But I think right now, when we're looking at these processes that are happening in different parts of the world, but that are all connected in terms of who's gaining power and what's happening with that, we need to work together.
I mean, that's a really positive.
Is it? I feel like it didn't sound very positive.
No, I think it is. And also, it sort of struck me that the book actually gestures towards, you know, albeit, you know, in a kind of very nuanced and caveated way, the idea that making connections might in itself be an aesthetic act, you know, that making connections might be the thing that we think about as the art, yeah, almost. And as you say, you know, the risk is that given what we know about the unequal power structures of the art world in Britain, the United States, and Western Europe, you know, the risks of misrepresentation are really kind of, you know, kind of grave. And actually, yeah, you know, kind of making connections might be a good banner to, you know, to kind of drive forward both aesthetic production and political change, which, again, as you mentioned, we really need right now. In terms of that kind of concluding point, is this the sort of stuff you're working on now, or have you kind of, you know, finished up the question of art activism, and have you moved on to something sort of completely different?
I haven't moved on completely, but I've kind of changed my focus, I'd say. So my current project is a project that looks at creative and cultural resistance to extractivism in Argentina. And by extractivism, I mean the economic model that's based on intensive and extensive extraction of natural resources for export. And it's a model that's been adopted by many countries in the global south, especially in Latin America. So what I'm looking at is how different sectors of society, from artists, but also to local assemblies, alternative media practitioners, environmental educators, how they're using arts and media to kind of counter the hegemonic narratives about development. So it's quite a big project. I'm just finishing the first part of it, and hopefully we'll be able to continue it with some further questions about kind of the cultural logic of extractivism and get into some more theoretical debates. But for now, it's been a good year and a half of doing interviews, traveling quite a bit, talking to artists and local assemblies, and getting an idea of the variety of practices that are happening in response to these hegemonic discourses and narratives that we hear in the media.
So are you planning another book?
Yes, I am planning another book. I think it's going to take a couple of years to write, because I would like to do some more ethnographic research. But yes, I am planning a book, and I'm hoping that would be in English and in Spanish.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. David Bryant, and today I was talking to Dr. Paola Serafini from the University of Leicester about performance action, the politics of art activism.